Guy James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Life! Life, you hear me? Is my creation! Life!
So this was fun.
You're gonna like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Give countdown.
Six, five, four, three, two, one.
You have entered a restricted broadcast area. You have entered a restricted broadcast.
Fellow American,
ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Well now, good afternoon, everybody. And welcome to the Guy James Show, coming to you from the beautiful blue waters and sandy beaches of Southwest Florida, Fort Myers, Naples area. So glad to have all of you along with us this afternoon. How you doing? Is it okay where you're at? Gosh, we've been getting some much needed rain here in Southwest Florida. Much needed rain, so we're happy about that. Been a tough week, though. Been a really tough week. First, the air conditioner went out, and you just can't hardly live in Florida without air conditioning, and you're talking about $5,000 to put in a new one. And then our little dog Sophie got a broken foot this week, and that's the tragedy around here. But anyway, she's on the mend and doing okay. So it's been one of those times. We all have them, don't we? Hey, we got a lot of things to talk about on the show today. Don't know exactly where we're going, really. I know that in the second hour, we're going to have Robert Borisage from the Campaign for America's Future on. We'll be heading to Washington a week from Monday to attend that annual conference, which is always a great one, just a great conference. It's going to be at the Omni Shoreham Hotel starting June 1st, so going to be there for that in a week from Monday. Is that right? 24th? Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right, a week from next Monday. So I am looking forward to that. Always enjoy our trip to the nation's capital. What else we got? We are waiting to hear from Senator Bernie Sanders' office. Senator Sanders had a very hectic schedule this afternoon, and they weren't sure yet whether they'd be able to get him on with us or not. So we're waiting to hear from them. And so if we get a quickie phone call right in the middle of all this from the 202 area code, why, we'll know who it is. They haven't let us know for sure yet. So I'm kind of not... have all my hopes pinned on that, because I know he has had a very, very busy day. But Bernie Sanders is always an interesting guy to hear from, especially today after we find out that they've finally done something about the credit card companies. And they did this, around 1 o'clock today. The Senate overwhelmingly passed a bill that would sharply curtail credit card issuers' ability to raise interest rates and charge fees. And this is from the Washington Post, taking a critical step in reforming an industry that's gone largely unregulated for decades. And you can say that again. In a 90-5 vote, now I don't know who the five were that did not vote. I know that Ted Kennedy's probably one. I'd like to know who the five are, and we'll try and find that out for you. Maybe you can find that out a little bit. 90-5 vote, The Senate delivered a victory to consumer groups and to the White House, who blame industry practices for sending Americans deeper into debt just as they're losing their jobs and their homes. And lawmakers will now turn to reconciling differences with a similar bill passed by the House on April 30th. Obama said he wants to sign the bill into law by Memorial Day. And consumer advocates said the Senate action showed a solid commitment to consumer protection. That's good to hear. Consumers need some protection from these loan sharks, and that's exactly, Senator Sanders actually put a bill through calling it some kind of a loan sharking bill. But they lobbied and lobbied against it, but somehow the people won this battle. And isn't it refreshing? Isn't it very refreshing? The House bill will put this in action a year from now, but the Senate bill would enact it in 9 months. So we'll see where this goes, and we'll see if it survives as the Senate put it forth through the House. They'll reconcile this, and consumers will get some relief anyway, we hope. We're going to talk about that today, what the heck has happened here in this country and how the money's been siphoned away from Americans. And boy, has it been siphoned away, and it's been a long, treacherous path by those in the know to suck the money out of circulation and put it in their private coffers. And we'll be talking quite a bit about that today. And as I mentioned, Robert Borisov from Campaign for America's Future is going to be with us a little later to talk about health care, single-payer health care. I don't know how many of you heard it, but Senator John Ensign, Republican, says the Gitmo detainees are getting better care than Americans. You know, that's something I wouldn't really brag about if I were him. Wouldn't brag about that at all. I mean, I'm glad they're getting good care. But to say that the average American Joe is not getting as good a care as people in prison, that's not a great statement to make about people here in the United States of America, do you think? And you can bet this. You can bet that the health care companies and the insurance companies are going to fight a single-payer system with every means available to them. They will fight it to the death. And that's going to be something very, very interesting to watch. And it's going to be interesting for me to watch and see if the Democrats have the stomach for the fight. That's what I'm waiting to see. Will they have the stomach to fight? We shall see. They've talked a good fight. They talked a good fight the last time when Hillary Clinton was leading the fight during the first couple of years of the Clinton administration. And they backed down. We'll see this time. We'll see if they have the stomach for it. And they've capitulated on some other things that I'm not real proud about. So we'll see how that goes. I noticed today that Senator Robert Byrd is in the hospital. He was hospitalized last Friday from what was described as a temperature spike, presumably the result of a nonspecific minor infection. Story goes on to say 91-year-old Robert Byrd is said to be responding well to the antibiotics and will remain in the hospital for at least a few more days. In recent years, health problems have plagued Byrd, who has served in the Senate longer than anyone in history. The Democrat was the first elected to the House in 1952 and then began his career in the Senate in 1958 when Republican Dwight David Eisenhower was president. Imagine that. 57 years in the United States Senate. While rarely missing Senate votes and hearings when in Washington, the once robust Byrd has grown frail and needs a wheelchair to move around. Last November, Byrd agreed to quit as chairman of the powerful Senate Appropriations Committee, but not before fighting members both Democrat and Republicans who sought his removal and And frankly, I don't say this to be mean or discriminate against older people, because I'm certainly getting there myself. But I believe a man 91 years old has no business whatsoever being a United States Senator. Absolutely not. Particularly when a man is in as frail a health as is Senator Byrd. I have nothing against Senator Byrd. He's a Democrat and he's done a lot of good for the state of West Virginia, and he's helped the Democrats over the years in a big way. But he is frail. His health is bad. And he's been in the Senate for 57 years, for God's sake. Isn't that enough? You know, it's like when Strom Thurmond was hanging in there to become the oldest senator in history. What was he? Did he make it to 100 years? I'm not sure. The guy didn't know his own name. He really didn't. And so I would ask people in the House and in the Senate, particularly in the Senate, that's where it seems to happen the most. You don't have to stay in the United States Senate until you die. Move on. Give somebody else a chance. I'm not so sure when you're 91 years old and in terrible health that you're doing anybody any good in the Senate. And so that's my 2 cents worth on that issue. And I, like I said, I don't say it to be mean or discriminating against older folks. God knows, well, I'll never make it to 91, but I just think that's taking advantage and selfish. That's what it is. It's selfish. Now people are going to say, oh, why'd you climb all over Robert Byrd over this? Well, I don't mean it personally. I just mean it for everybody. And then we've had this torture situation rise to the top of the news again, and I am glad. I thought the swine flu was going to keep it off permanently, that they would let it drop, but evidently some people are tenacious enough to keep it going for as long as they can. That's fine with me. Because I believe, and I know many of you believe, that whoever was involved in that should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, the people that carried it out, the people that ordered it done, the people that said it was legal. Every single one of them up the chain should be prosecuted and imprisoned if found guilty of torture. That is something this country does not do. I think we can all agree now that it is torture, waterboarding. You can take your term enhanced interrogation and put it you know where. Torture is torture. And I got a kick out of a former governor from Minnesota talking about it. What was it he said the other day? You give me a waterboard and Dick Cheney, and, what, 1 hour, and I'll get him to confess to the Sharon Tate murders? Well, absolutely. He knows what torture is. Pelosi, Cheney, Bush, torture, you know, we're hearing a lot about the torture issue, and that is a good thing. And the question is, are Cheney and Bush and their henchmen guilty of condoning illegal acts by our government? And you know where I stand. I believe that they are absolutely, absolutely guilty of condoning illegal acts by our government. Is Pelosi lying? Who knows? I did see where there was big differences between Bob Graham and the CIA. Bob Graham, a man known for taking meticulous notes and diaries all day, every day, about every action he takes. And about how many times they met, and he says the CIA is wrong. I'll tell you this much, if it comes down to believing Bob Graham or the CIA on the accuracy of these briefings, I'll take Bob Graham's word any day of the week. I don't care what Norm Panetta says. He wasn't there. And evidently on a few cases, Neither was the CIA, says Bob Graham. And you can take that to the bank. If there's a difference, if there are differences between what happened, when it happened, how many times they met, and the difference comes down between the word of Bob Graham and the CIA, believe Bob Graham every time. So, in the Pelosi matter, I don't know. I've never been a big Pelosi fan, and she is, after all, a politician. So lying isn't something that is necessarily against her principles. But what makes me ashamed of this whole mess is that a fair number of Americans think it's okay to torture or to do whatever's necessary to extract information from our enemies. A good deal of that, I think it's something like 42% think it's okay. Well, I don't. It's either, there's no gray area here. And you can forget that ticking time bomb scenario. We weren't facing that. But when it gets to the point where 42% of Americans think torturing somebody, you know, that drags us down to the lowest level along with the people that we've criticized throughout this whole thing about the people that, you know, whacked people's heads off and done various other, you know, incredibly terrible acts. If we found out that our soldiers were being waterboarded, this country would go nuts. You know that. And that's why some of this, that kind of stuff has been, some our soldiers have been spared some of that stuff in the past few years in conflicts we've been in. Because they know that hell definitely would have no fury, like Americans finding out that their captured soldiers had been tortured. I'm not saying it hasn't happened, but you better believe that some of the other countries involved in conflicts with us over the past few years have been better to evidently haven't lowered themselves to the torture that we have. And so that's the thing that bothers me in all this. And the polls show that the fundamentalist Christians are for it in big numbers, big numbers. And I would say to those people, it's time to the fundies, the fundamentalist Christians, the evangelicals, I would say to them, it's time for you to decide who you are. Are you going to be the kind of people who support torture and prisoner abuse and extraordinary rendition? Or are you going to be followers of Christ's message like you say you are, like you pretend to? You know, the one that embraces the idea of agape and believes in turning the other cheek and believes that the peacemakers are blessed and that the meek shall inherit the earth. Those Christians I'm talking about. There's that old adage that the devil can quote scripture, as can those who further his agenda here on earth. And if there was any doubt before, now we know that this is absolutely true. So I say to the fundamentalist Christians who are all for this extraordinary rendition and these acts of torture, who are you going to follow? You're going to follow Christ or Satan? Because it's really that simple. The choice in this is clear. I'm not necessarily a believer in a black and white world, but in this case, it's the blackest black versus the whitest white. And that's even before we get into the issue of whether torture is even effective. And I think most thinking people understand right now that the overwhelming evidence says it is not effective in the overall picture. So you have a choice. You do have a choice. What is in your heart? Because if this stuff seems okay to you, I don't think you want to know the real answer to that question, what's in your heart. And I wouldn't be hoping for the rapture to be coming any time soon if I were you, if that's what's in your heart. You know, when you see these memos that went out to the White House from the Defense Department, Donald Rumsfeld, I see he didn't necessarily write these things, but, hey, he's the boss. The buck stops here. He was the boss. You know, therefore put on the full armor of God so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground, and after you have done everything, to stand. It comes from Ephesians. And another one, commit to the Lord whatever you do, and your plans will succeed. And it's God's will that by doing good, you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish men. You know, smite thine enemy. Well, who knows what that caused by sending memos to the White House to a very vulnerable to this kind of talk, weak-minded president. Rummy knew he was weak-minded. Cheney knew he was weak-minded. And they send this kind of stuff to him in a memo? Mm-hmm. You know exactly where they were going with this. And you know it was effective because they did make it sound like it was a crusade. Because we are the righteous people. In any conflict, it is us who are the righteous people. And George Bush is weak-minded enough that he believed all of this. That it was a crusade, that it was a message from God that we should go after Saddam Hussein and kill how many hundred thousand Iraqis. A message from God. He repeated that to a couple of foreign leaders that he felt he was on a mission from God. You know, that's dangerous when a leader of a country like ours starts talking like that. That's really dangerous. So I hope a lot comes of this. I see that one of the notables in the Bush administration, and she certainly was, and I never understood why, wasn't somebody remind me, wasn't Karen Hughes, wasn't she a newspaper reporter or TV reporter or something in Texas before she was taken to be with the Bush administration? Isn't that what she was? You know, off of Think Progress, they had a story in about her now. She's trying to distance herself from this torture. She knows what went on. Last month, Philip Zelikow disclosed that while serving as a top aide to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice in 2005, he had written and circulated a memo expressing grave concerns about the Bush administration's torture regime. And another memo, Zelikow co-authored at around the same time, even offered a legal alternative to the program. And now it turns out that strong opposition to President Bush's interrogation policies came from within his tight-knit circle. And make no mistake about it, Karen Hughes was part of that tight-knit circle. Karen Hughes, counselor to the president, told the Houston Chronicle this week that she was very vocal in the internal debate. She acknowledged the current uproar over interrogation tactics and allegations of prisoner torture during the Bush years. And I quote her, "I was very vocal in the internal debate," she says. "I worried about how that would make us look in the eyes of the world." Well, didn't we all? And didn't we all say so then? "But I had left the White House when a lot of that was taking place." Ah, I see. It was wrong, but I was out of there and I had no part. Then she paused, worried for the first time in 90 minutes in this interview that she'd made a gaffe. Whatever John McCain says about interrogation techniques, she added quickly, she had similar views. And thank you on the Internet, Ray, for letting me know. Karen Hughes did work, in fact, in TV. And she ends up being a counselor to the president. I think the biggest travesty of all with George W. Bush, and I don't want to make this a show about George Bush, but we can talk about his administration all we want to, and the horrors of that administration in almost every manner you can think of, domestically here with what's happened, and where we're reaping the we're reaping the rewards of it now, if you want to call them rewards, of his fiscal policy here in this country. It was a disaster. He left Barack Obama with the worst recession since the Great Depression. And foreign policy left us with two wars. He left the reputation of the United States around the world in shambles. Most of the rest of the world looks at us now as a bunch of arrogant warmongers. Or they did up until the time that Barack Obama started going around and visiting and creating some goodwill once again for this country. And thank God for that. But even all of that is, we can talk about those, and some of those points I was going to say could be argued, but they really cannot. You cannot argue that the Bush administration was a disaster. I did see Sean Hannity yesterday when he was asked as to whether or not Bush had been a good president, and he thinks that we were better off after the Bush administration than when he came in, and that is so laughable. The former governor of Minnesota certainly told him so. And it is. That's laughable. Anybody who will make a statement like that, that we were better off when George Bush left office than we were when he came in, anybody that would say that that's the truth, you don't want to bother arguing with because they're just a fool. They're a zealot, a crazy zealot, or a fool, in which case that's the same. Those are the same things. So, really, the biggest mistakes of the Bush administration were probably of George Bush himself, were the mistakes of appointing the people in his administration that he did early on. That was the biggest mistake he made, because after that he was out of it and wasn't running the country basically for most all of his administration. I think we all know that, and for the insiders pretty much will tell you that. But what a horrible mistake it was putting Dick Cheney in as vice president. That's probably the number one bad mistake he made. And of course, Cheney then was responsible for helping getting Rumsfeld in as Secretary of Defense, a terrible mistake, getting the job that Cheney himself had once held. And then they get the likes of a Douglas Feith and some of these others in. You remember the Harriet Myers saga? So one after another of his appointments, Gonzalez, turned out to be just frightening. And we can now look back and see, I don't know if we realized it at first just how bad it was going to be. But we can now go, Paul Wolfowitz, oh my God. The guy was a freak. So you go back and look at some of these people that were put in office by Junior Bush at the start of his administration, and you knew that if you didn't know what subsequently happened after that, and I was able just to tell you who these people were that he appointed, you would say, hey, we're headed for a disaster. Turns out that was the case. It was a disaster. We have seen, as of late, Dick Cheney, for example, that there's a man who's a true sociopath. And evidently his daughter is as well. And, of course, I have always wondered about his wife, too. I'd like to be in that household for a while and hear what the hell they would talk about. I would like to be in a room with Cheney and Rumsfeld and hear what they have to say to one another. You're talking about some nutcases that were appointed and zealots, and they were appointed by a weak-minded president. that wasn't, in my opinion, and never will change my mind on this, that wasn't legally elected in the first place. He was appointed. I'll never believe that the American people elected him to the first term, and of course, if that hadn't been the case, he would never have been around for the second term. Just imagine, when you think back, as an aside here, going off on a tangent, but of all the Supreme Court cases that have taken place in this nation, down through the years, so you know, some really important Supreme Court cases about civil rights, about education, about labor laws, all the huge decisions, had any of them had more terrible ramifications than the appointment of Junior Bush to the presidency of the United States? Has the Supreme Court ever made a worse decision than that? And, folks, the proof is in the pudding, don't you think? I don't think it's even debatable, except these zealots would debate it, of course. And now you see some of them jumping ship. Karen Hughes? Interesting. That says a lot. Karen Hughes. Now backing down from a lot of this. Wow. Hey, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes, and we hope you'll stay with us. Billy Joel, I like that. I like Billy Joel, always did. He's a heck of a piano player, good singer too, Good songwriter, Billy Joel. Haven't heard much from him lately. I don't keep up on the showbiz sort of thing. Wasn't he married to some... Was he married to... I don't know, what, Cindy Crawford? Was he married to her? I don't know. I can't keep up with that stuff. I heard that this guy that headed up this teabag movement in the country, here they were out protesting taxes and fighting for the American way to save us from the Obama administration and higher taxes. Well, it turns out the guy hadn't paid his taxes at all. Turns out that he, over the past 16 years, amassed nearly $150,000 in state and federal tax liens, small claims court judgments, and civil suit. Michael P. Leahy. And he is one of the top conservatives that help this whole teabagging thing. The head teabagger. How'd you like to have that moniker? I'm the number one. Yeah, you'd probably be Michael Leahy and say, I'm the number one teabagger. Yeah. I still don't think they get that, do you? Maybe not. Hey, and isn't it sad, get off the subject again for a moment. I seem to be doing that today. How'd you like to be a guy that, and I know a couple of people that their families have been in the automotive business for many decades. I can think of one back in Ohio that their family's been in selling Chrysler automobiles for, I don't know how many years, 75 years. Stuck with it through thick and thin. When Chrysler was having big problems through the 60s and then the 70s, they had quality problems in the 60s. And then they had the nearly bankrupt problem, and they got pulled out of that. And they stuck with them. And now the company comes along and said, I'm sorry, you're done. And, of course, General Motors having done the same thing. Because maybe they're small dealerships and not. Although, I did read in the paper that the Byers Company in Columbus, Ohio, who is a big, big purveyor of automobile sales, believe me, huge, that they've had a couple of their dealerships taken away. They got bitten twice. They had one of their Chevrolet dealerships taken away and one of their Chrysler dealerships taken away. So they got hit twice. So it's not just the little guy necessarily. But how'd you like to be in a family business like that all those years? And you stuck with the Chrysler, for example, through thick and thin. And now this. They come along and tell you, I'm sorry, Bub, you're out of business. There's not much we can do for you. Really realize you've built this dealership and you've worked in it for 75 years. You and your family put your blood, sweat, and tears in it, but it's over with. And when it comes down to it, the dealers weren't responsible. I knew a guy really well that worked at a Chrysler Plymouth dealership back during the late 50s and the 60s. And he told me that when the truck pulled up usually with the first load of cars on, that the designs were so bad during a few of those years that when a truck pulled up with the first load of new cars for the year came on and the new designs came out for the Chrysler company, that the salesmen would all go get drunk because they knew it was going to be a tough year. They did have some. What year was it? The 61, 62 Plymouth? Oh, man. They had some ugly cars. But, and they're right on the... on the chat room, Latter-J says any type of loyalty went away a long time ago, and it's true, in the 60s. It's that way all over, isn't it? Not very many of Americans going to be wearing gold watches as a retirement gift anymore, is there? First of all, companies be too cheap to give you a gold watch for 30, 40 years of service. And secondly, nobody works that long for anybody anymore. Many, many people my age, when you got out of school, many people thought, well, they'll get a job with at the local factory, whatever, and work there until they retire, and they just accepted that as their lot. And some of us went to school afterwards. But they planned on working for a company for 30 years and then retiring and living happily ever after in a modest way, not necessarily living to be rich or anything like that, but those were the plans. That's what people did in the 60s. They got out of school. They got a job with a Timken roller bearing company in Ohio, or a Packard Electric company in Ohio, or any Chrysler, or a Ford assembly plant in Detroit, or a Buick assembly plant in Flint, Michigan, or I can't think of that one in Ohio, big Lordstown. So you got a job, and you didn't have any higher education, so you went there and you planned, well, I'm going to work here for 30 years, and then I'm going to retire, and that's what we do, raise a couple of kids and get a new car every 3-4 years and buy a house with a picket fence and all that, have a vacation once in a while. That was the American way. That's what everybody strived to do. That was life. And it wasn't so bad. I really could never plan on, never could really stand the thought of going to work for somebody for 30 years, but a lot of my friends did. And that's all right. There's nothing wrong with that. But very few people are going to get the chance to do that anymore. You will not have the chance to work and get a gold watch upon retirement because, number one, you'd be lucky to get any retirement. Number two, the company that you work for may go belly up. Chances are they will before 30 years are up. And the way relations are between employees and their employers these days, in the large companies anyway, they're liable to tell you that, a couple of years before you're ready to retire and draw your retirement, they might tell you just to get the hell out. I know a couple of cases of that as well. I know a couple of cases of people that were 30 years and out, not old enough to draw Social Security yet, got a job right out of high school, worked 28 years for a company. Boom, they're gone. You know what they got? They got squat. So they're not going to be any more gold watches. And relations between the people they work with and the employees, employers, and these big companies, they don't give a damn about you. Probably never did, but it's worse now than it ever was. So I guess I started talking about all this about because of these automotive dealerships, and just think about that, how far that goes. The mechanics, the sales staff, the office staff, a lot of people going to be out of jobs. And it's a shame. It really is. And I don't know who the fault really belongs with. It belongs with the executives that ran the country, the companies. It belongs part of the blame with Americans out buying cars now. I will say this. I believe in my heart and soul that Americans make just as good of cars as anybody else in the world does right now. I believe that. Absolutely believe that. And if you don't think that, you haven't driven any newer American cars lately. And they're very competitive these days, but a lot of Americans got used to buying foreign cars, and that's the way it stayed. So there's blame to go all the way around. And, of course, the southern states, Ohio, I think, is actually the first one to start it, having Honda come in. But now we've got plants throughout the South, and they come in where there's no unions. And, we've got American Toyotas, we've got American Hondas, we've got American Nissans, I don't know, we've got all kinds of American foreign cars where the money's being shipped back overseas. So, it's not what it once was, and as we've mentioned so many times on this program, when all of this is over and done with, when this recession is over, and I expect it to be some time before it's over, because I still don't think we've run across some of the terrible ramifications of it. We haven't hit bottom yet. A lot of people think we have. I don't agree. But when it's all over with, we're not good. And I know a lot of people are looking forward to going back the way things were. It's not going to happen. It's never, ever going to happen. We will not go back to the consumerism, the type of consumerism we had before. Like I've said before, I don't think the planet would stand it. You know, we're just now starting to figure out that we don't own the planet. We belong to the planet. And indeed, Mother Earth can't be just another piece of merchandise. And so we can charge on with nonstop unfettered capitalism, or we can get on some sort of a track with where we've got some sort of harmony with the planet and respect for life. And people will ultimately understand that the Earth is a whole lot more important than the stock exchange of Wall Street. And that life has to change on this Earth. We cannot continue the consumerism as we've had in the past. Life will change, and it will be altered drastically in these United States before it's all over with. I'm going to pause for a break. We'll be back.
I had a dream. Of a fairy tale, you can take the future, even if you fail. I believe in angels, something good in everything I see. I believe in angels, when I know the time. Destination makes it worth the while.
I have a dream. I do have a dream. You know, we had a great speech in this country that was a dream. I have a dream. And his dream, much of it has been realized. And I have a dream that when things start turning around and things get better financially for people in this country, that just because life will be different, I don't think it will be worse. I don't necessarily think it'll be worse. I don't think it'll be worse if we can't have big screen TVs in every room. I don't think it'll be worse if we, you know, have great big huge homes that we don't use all of. We used to all live in smaller homes. We didn't have any wasted space in our homes. Well, many of us do now. We can downsize and be happy. We can have a good standard of living and be happy and still respect the earth. So things don't necessarily have to be bad. Things will be different. Maybe we'll get our brains turned on finally and have a decent mass transit in this country where we won't all have to own an automobile and pay car insurance on it. That'll take away a little bit of our freedom of being able to drive, but we'll still be able to go where we want to go. But things will just change. Things change gradually to where we got to where we are today, and they'll change gradually to wherever it is we're going in the future. But it can still be a great world. It can still be a wonderful place to live in, here in this country, and we can still have our freedoms, and we can still have a great standard of living, just in a different way than we've had. We're just going to have to slow it down a little bit. Things will change. That's all. I don't know where all the jobs are going to come from. There's going to have to be a lot of jobs come up here, and I don't know where they're going to come from. You know, only so many people can work at McDonald's and Walmart. And you know how I feel about Walmart. I'm sorry anybody has to work at Walmart. But I believe they still are the nation's largest employer, are they not? I think that's the case. I don't like the fact that that's the case, but a lot of people are at their mercy. Of course, no unions to protect the workers, and Walmart is seeing to it with the help of our government all along. No organizing. And I do believe that as long as we have the unions stuck in a corner where they can't have any power, when labor organizations have been neutered, I think it'll be a long time until things get decent for the middle class again. Probably a very long time. It's remarkable the tenacity that some of these companies have against unions. I've seen it firsthand myself. I've told you about my story, getting fired during a union organization that didn't work out, threatened and fired. End up getting my job back through the Labor Relations Board, along with others. But those tactics are being used again today, and people are not getting their jobs back through the Labor Relations Board. The worker has very little protection these days, very, very little. And that's why we need unions. We need good, strong unions. We need good, strong unions without some of the abuses that the unions brought upon themselves. These deals around the country with certain unions, automotive unions, UAW, guys working and, getting paid and not working. Well, if you're not on unemployment or on vacation, you shouldn't be getting paid for not working. That's my opinion. So if there is a good labor movement that will take place in this country again, they're going to have to remember the past and remember that the unions have been guilty of excesses as well. But hopefully it'll all sort itself out. Kind of feel like I'm rambling today, but I've got so many things on my mind right now about what's wrong and what's right in this country. We're going to have Robert Borisage from the Campaign for America's Future coming up in the second hour, right after we come back, I think. And we'll talk to him about health care and the upcoming annual convention, going to be held at the Omni Shoreum in Washington, D.C., an event I look forward to every year. They always have many great guests for us to have. When we visit there, we'll be doing our show live there June 1st and 2nd, Monday and a Tuesday. We'll be live from D.C., so I am looking forward to that. And always enjoy having Bob on. I think we had Bob on, well, every year when we do the convention, but also I think we had him on at the Democratic National Convention this past year, and I think we had him on also at the inaugural when we did a remote from the inaugural. Boy, I was thinking back about that inaugural the other day. I was talking to some friends that were there. I went to this soiree down in Naples where Democratic Chairman Jim Kane was at, and met some people I hadn't talked to before that were at the inaugural, and they were talking about how god-awful cold it was. And you know, it's something that, and it was, it was really cold, really cold, but it's something that didn't bother me that much for some reason when I was there. There was too much excitement. There was too much going on. There was too much history being made to have that be a factor. And I'm sure some people, you know, had to take it as a factor because of their health and all that. Cold, even though I live in Florida, cold really doesn't bother me that much. Never did. But that's not why I live in Florida, by the way, and I've explained many times. Not because of the cold. Not at all. I live in Florida because of the 5 or 6 months of gray skies up north I used to see every year. I like the sunshine. Cold, who cares, you know? Never bothered me much. Hey, we're going to pause for the news coming up at the top of the hour here in just a moment. And 866-546-5254, 866-546-5254. And when we come back, we're going to have Robert Borisage from Campaign for America's Future, and we look forward to talking to him, and we look forward to having all of you back with us as well. So stay tuned. We'll be back with the news after the news in just a couple of minutes. You're listening to The Guy James Show on the Head On Radio Network.
Listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Obama administration is not requiring GM to maximize U.S. jobs, despite having enormous leverage over the company, and despite President Obama's pledge to save or create millions of jobs. The United Auto Workers Union is telling members of Congress that to qualify for any more government assistance, GM ought to have to maximize the number of U.S. jobs. The union objects to GM's plan to increase the number of cars imported from China, Mexico, and other low-wage countries to be sold here in the U.S. Auto workers will join the United Steelworkers on Capitol Hill today to drive home the message that the U.S. auto industry and U.S. manufacturing in general needs to be renewed with increases in U.S. production and U.S. manufacturing jobs. GM is wiping out 21,000 U.S. jobs as it uses tax dollars to restructure the company. In addition to slashing those jobs, GM will reduce the number of imports from its Canadian and European operations while increasing the number of vehicles brought in from low-wage countries. The growing crisis in the auto sector is having ripple effects around the globe. Jesse Russell reports.
Workers who occupied their former factory for 7 weeks walked out on Monday with one bittersweet victory under their belts and a second battle on the horizon. More than 200 former workers at a Visteon car parts plant in Belfast have been occupying the plant since they were told the plant would be closed 7 weeks ago. The workers demanded a better redundancy deal from the company before they would leave the plant. The Belfast plant was one of three closed in the UK, with workers being given less than an hour's notice that they were out of jobs. The workers accepted a better plan, and on Monday left the plant two by two, led by a bagpiper. The next fight will be to secure their pensions. And workers of a Continental Tire factory in France continue to protest the plant closing of that plant. On Monday, workers burned tires in front of the old Paris stock market in an attempt to bring attention to the plight of the 1,120 workers who will soon be out of a job. Union representatives of the workers will meet with managers of the German-based company today in an attempt to negotiate the planned 2010 closure. Here is today's economic report. A recent study suggests 20% of U.S. homeowners owe more on their mortgage than their homes are worth. The result, according to an article this weekend in the Wall Street Journal, is more homeowners underwater, making it difficult to refinance, sell their homes, or take advantage of lower interest rates. According to Zillow.com, 20.4 million borrowers were underwater in the first quarter. That's up 4.1 million just one quarter prior.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
If you don't clean up your room, the Board of Health is going to condemn it.
The Board of Health doesn't even know about your room. What's more, they don't care.
You know, if you keep making that face, it's going to freeze that way.
Not unless you're someplace really, really cold. Actually, a lot of the warnings moms hand out are a bit exaggerated.
If you don't get your blood pressure checked, you could have high blood pressure, not even know it, and you could die from a stroke.
But she's right about that one. Fact is, high blood pressure contributes to 200,000 American deaths each year. And a third of those who have high blood pressure don't know it. If they did, it'd be simple to treat. Call the American Heart Association at 1-800-AHA-USA1 or visit AmericanHeart.org on the web to learn more. Better still, ask your doctor to check your blood pressure.
If you run with those scissors,
it's the least you can do.
The Guy James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Life, you hear me? Give my creation life.
So this was fun.
You're gonna like this.
Let's go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Good countdown. Six. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered the restricted broadcast area. You have entered the restricted broadcast.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. Glad to have all of you along with me. This is the Guy James Show coming to you from the beautiful blue waters and sandy beaches of Southwest Florida. Ah, yes. We've been asked about the saga of the puppy, Sophie. She's not a puppy anymore. She's full grown. She weighs 10 pounds, actually. They'll always be puppies, you know. Sophie and Kukla, the official Guy James Show puppies. I think Kukla's maybe 2 years, 2 years and 3 or 4 months, and Sophie's about 4 months younger than that. So anywhere, they're in that neighborhood, and they both weigh about 10 pounds, although Sophie's smaller in stature. And anyways, we had to go to emergency veterinarian place on, Sunday evening. Gosh, always something, isn't it? But Sophie's doing well. And just a wonderful little dog. Man, her and Kukla both. So I'm happy that they're okay. We're waiting to hear from Robert Borsas from the Campaign for America's Future. Actually, it's ourfuture.org. And we'll see if he'd be checking in with us any time now, I would say. Let's see. Make sure the phone's all... Yeah, it's ready to go. So, that's always the trouble when I have somebody call me instead of me call them. You know how I am about time. I'm an absolute time freak. Just a time freak. Man, oh, man. Anyway, while we wait for Bob to call, now we have Obama meeting with Bibi Netanyahu. Personally, I'll tell you the truth, I don't like the guy. I never did. I don't mean Obama, I mean Netanyahu. I think he's a hawk. I think the last thing in the world we need is another hawk leading up the Likud people in Israel. I think the last thing we need in the world is a hawk to lead the Israelis. And so he comes to Washington, and Obama supposedly told him that the settlements have to be stopped. I don't know about that. Let's take this call. Hello?
Guy James.
Speaking.
Bob Borsage calling.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
Good.
Hey, let's just go live right now.
Okay.
We've got with us now Bob Borsage from ourfuture.org, somebody we've had on this program and I've interviewed in Washington many times, and ahead of a great organization. That's been around how long now, Bob?
Well, we started back in 96, but we really started taking off in 2000.
My goodness. And how many conferences is this? What number is this one coming up?
This is this will be the sixth big one. You know, this conference used to be known as Take Back America. This year, for the first time, we changed the name to America's Future Now, on the theory that right now we can forge America's future, and it's time for progressives to keep moving.
Yeah, this is no time to just sit back and relax and take it easy. And I know you haven't been. You've been right up front with your comments and all about health care and other issues that confront Americans every day. The conference is coming up June 1st, right?
Right, 1st through 3rd at the Omni Shoreham in Washington, D.C. We're expecting once more activists and leaders from across the progressive tribes and across the country gathering to really plot strategy over the next period of time. We have the potential now for the greatest period of progressive reform since the 1960s. But there's lots of entrenched opposition. There's big-time lobbies gearing up to try to stop health care reform, to try to gut the Employee Free Choice Act, to try to dilute the climate and energy bills. And so this conference will be focusing on how to mobilize and how to keep moving.
And you're right, the opposition is hunkering down, they're digging bunkers, and they're going to fight, they're not going to give up the fight on the health care, are they? They're showing no intentions, they're going to be rather tenacious about it.
Well, and tenacious and clever and putting an unbelievable amount of money in it. I tell you, it's a salad day if you're a Democratic lobby these days. You can make a lot of money in this market. But that's why citizens really have to mobilize now. You know, we've got a crisis that demands change. You know, you can't keep having these health care costs go up the way they are without bankrupting everybody. You've got a president committed to it. You've got a Democrats in control of both houses in Congress. It's really time to deliver, but it's going to take a real aroused citizens' movement to overcome these entrenched interests that are trying to stop things from happening.
What do you think our chances are? They're going to spend millions on lobbying, the opposition is. Do you think we'll get a really good bite at the apple, or will we just be nibbling around and have to start off small? How do you see this is taking place right now?
Well, I think it's going to vary from issue to issue, and I think it's going to be, I think they are going to have the ability to really compromise some things, and other things I think we can push through. So, for example, I think they've mobilized an unbelievable opposition to the Employee Free Choice Act, and it looks like that would have a hard time getting through the Senate now, and it's going to have to do some negotiations to figure out what they're going to do. On the other hand, I think healthcare and having a public plan to compete with private insurers as a choice in healthcare for everyone, I think that still has a very good chance. The president seems behind it. We've got a real shot at that in the next month or two.
Well, you're sitting there in the belly of the beast. Do you think there's any Republican support for this whatsoever?
Well, in healthcare, for the most part, the Republicans have made themselves the party of the no. They've just been in obstruction mode. That doesn't matter in the House. They don't have enough numbers in the House to make much of a difference. But in the Senate, it has mattered. And again, on the Employee Free Choice Act, I think there are really no Republican votes that have been committed to it, at least. On the healthcare reforms, you have a number of Republican senators that have at least joined the discussion. Now, whether they can be brought along to the point necessary to have a plan that's realistic and that can actually do something, it remains to be seen. But they're at least not completely shutting the door. And that reflects, of course, the fact that the insurance companies and the hospitals realize they better be at the table rather than simply trying to stop anything from happening.
Well, what do you think about some of the Democratic senators in conservative states, people like Dorgan and Kent Conrad, perhaps, and John Tester, and some of them? Where are they standing on it?
Again, it varies from issue to issue. I think the hardest part we have is dealing with conservative senators. And we need their votes to be able to overcome, you know, you get the supermajorities that are needed to pass anything these days. And on the other hand, they are, I think, a number of them are more likely to be voting their interests, that is, the people who give them money, than their constituents. You know, to say they're from conservative states, I think, is sort of doesn't quite get it right in these circumstances. You know, a lot of these states, people have been devastated, and they're looking for help, and they are looking for significant change, and they would support a senator who was out there fighting for this basic stuff, health care and, you know, new jobs through new energy and a way for workers to organize and, you know, et cetera. But we're going to need a mobilization to be able to make sure these senators pay attention to their voters and not simply their donors.
Well, a senator, for example, like Max Baucus, we all know what took place there, a week or two ago with the hearings that they've been having, and nobody from single payer at the table. Of course, a senator like Baucus has received a great amount of money from the opposition to a single payer system. Do we have a chance with somebody like him?
Not on single payer. There's no question that that's been ruled off the table. But I do think we have a chance with him of getting a public plan like Medicare as a choice that anyone can choose as a choice to the insurance they have now. And if we get that, then that over time will make us, will take us way down the line, I think, towards single payer.
What, on that type of plan that you just mentioned, a Medicare type plan, what parameters, age, income, all that are you thinking that would work in that?
Well, no, this would be an attempt to do a plan, a public plan that would be offered to anyone, to the small, to any business that wanted to use it to supply insurance for their employees or to any individual looking for insurance. And what the idea is to have a public option that is, that competes with the private insurance companies, that forces them to compete on price and on service and in a sense provides a benchmark that keeps them from doing the kinds of price gouging and super profits that they've done. You know, what's happened in the medical insurance business is that these markets have gotten very concentrated, so that in many states, one insurance company, one private insurance company, provides insurance for over 50% of all the small businesses, say, in the state. That means it has a huge effect on the ability to set price and to reap super profits. If they have to compete with a public plan that any business could take as an alternative, or any employee could take as an alternative, there would be real limits on, there'd be a real competition about cost and about what's offered in the plan, et cetera, and I think it would have a huge effect in limiting cost structure. So that's the point, is to try to get a plan. There's no age, you know, open to anybody under, I mean, once they get to Medicare, they don't need it, but open to anybody under 65, limit on wage, an alternative to the insurance that people might get from their employer.
Realistically, how much do you think, what kind of savings are you talking about, that we could do it for 50% of what the privatized companies are doing, or is anybody come up with a figure on that?
The estimates have been that you could save, I believe it was 20% of the cost, the increased cost of healthcare over 10 years by this competition. That it would have just a dramatic effect on the trajectory of healthcare costs. It's not as much as a single payer system would save. But it is dramatically more than simply leaving the private insurance companies to do this job without the option.
Well, we're faced with a situation of having executives that don't know much about actual health care, making life and death decisions over profit. And I've always felt that that's absolutely wrong. It's just not something that we can continue to do in this country, and we've seen a lot of horrible examples of what can happen when a system is run that way. You'll hear the argument about the bureaucracy. What's your best argument for saying a bureaucracy can run a healthcare system?
Well, I think if you look at any healthcare system, private, public, etc., you know, people are sick when they go to doctors or hospitals, and so there's lots of complaints, and none of them work very well. And so that's a universal reality. I think when you look at it in kind of a macro level, you step back from it, there's no question that the European systems all get better healthcare results than we get in terms of life expectancy and death at childbirth and treatment of long-term illnesses, and they spend much less as a percent of GDP in doing it. So they are all more efficient and get better healthcare results, which is quite striking, than we do. So we have the worst of all possible worlds. We're spending the most in terms of the percentage of our economy than any country in the world, and we're getting results that are lagging behind most of the industrialized countries. So in that regard, then, it's clear that public plans can provide citizens with better health care, partly because they will put more emphasis on preventive care. They put more emphasis on kind of the public health aspects of diet and exercise, et cetera, that the private insurance companies really just don't. They insure when you get sick. They don't really insure to keep you – they don't work to keep you healthy. Moving to a public plan or to a public plan option would have a dramatic effect on on costs and on producing, I think, better outcomes for people.
Well, we certainly know that there's a terrific need for it. It's something's got to be done. We're talking with Robert Borsage. Bob is head of a great organization and founder, one of the founders of the OurFuture.org. The conference is coming up, and as I understand it, do you still have any openings for the people to attend the conference?
Oh, yeah, we've still got space, and it's not just about healthcare. It's about all of the major initiatives that are going forward, plus a lot of other reforms that have to go on as we move into this period. We'll also be looking at what's happening in Afghanistan and challenging the premise of our policy there. We'll be talking about the military budget and real security. We'll be looking at the whole range of progressive issues as they now are reframed in the age of Obama and looking at how the progressive movement ought to be organizing itself to take advantage and to push the greatest reform we can at this moment.
Yeah, and lest anybody get the wrong idea, this isn't a deal where you all just sit in a big auditorium and listen to somebody speak all day long. Yeah, there are many, many, it breaks up into many, many small seminars, if you will, over every issue under the sun and with some of the most notable speakers you can imagine. Bob, do you have any kind of a list for us of the speakers going to be at the event this year?
Yeah, we'll have everybody from Nobel Prize winners like Joe Stiglitz, the famous economy, to senators like Bernie Sanders and Tom Harkin and Sherrod Brown and Jeff Merkley from Oregon, to leading congresspeople, Jan Schakowsky and George Miller and Barbara Lee and John Conyers and Barney Frank, to the leading activists and union leaders of the time, Leo Gerard and you know, kind of the leaders of the sort of new progressive movements that have pushed forward on healthcare and on employment and on the environment. Carl Pope will be there from the Sierra Club, for example. It's you know, a seven-ring circus. There's an extraordinary array of talent there, both in the audience and on the stage, and lots of discussions going on in the hallways that are the richest of all. It's just a high-energy place, and it's a great venue for people to come and plot and get energy for the struggles to come.
Oh yeah, was it last year? Wasn't it last year at the banquet we had Norman Lear and Bill Moyers?
Right.
Oh,
right.
What an evening! What an evening! And Phil Donahue was attended the thing last year, and all of just. The whole community's there. You should go if at all possible. Bob, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Guy James Show today. I look forward to seeing you in Washington once again and attending another great radio row there like you always have. Your organization's always so hospitable and has all the details taken care of, and we look forward to attending again. And it's ourfuture.org, right?
Our future, OURfuture.org. You can sign up for the conference. It's America's Future Now, and it is time. We can forge our future right now.
You bet we can, and with your help and your leader, part of your leadership. Thank you so much. Bob Borsage of OurFuture.org. Bob, thank you once again.
Take care.
He is somebody that is a name that many of you don't recognize, perhaps, but a person behind the scenes, not completely behind the scenes, but somebody well known in Washington. And when Bob speaks, people listen. Do visit their website. I know you will enjoy it, and there's a lot of great people who write great articles on the website, including Bob. And I just know that you will enjoy it very much. I think Robert Greenwald is going to be at the conference this year. I always look forward to seeing him, and really a great group. You listen to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. We're going to take just a moment or two, and we'll be back. Don't go away.
Stars above the radar range. A song from a station.
Ah, me and Jigs. I love that song. I do. 866-546-52, 5254, if you'd like to join us here on the program. Phones are up and running today. We were talking before the news a little bit about Netanyahu, the ultimate hawk, coming to Washington, D.C. to talk to Obama. And isn't it interesting at the time that he comes to Washington that Israel's moving ahead with a plan to build a new settlement in the northern West Bank? That's the first time they've done that in 26 years. And, you know, that's a project the United States has already condemned. And we know that it's an obstacle to peace efforts in that area. And so, Obama has said that these settlements have to be stopped. Let me quote Obama. He said, "Now Israel is going to have to take some difficult steps as well. And I shared with the Prime Minister the fact that under the roadmap, under Annapolis, there's a clear understanding that we have to make progress on settlements, that settlements have to be stopped in order for us to move forward. That's a difficult thing to recognize, but it's an important one, and it has to be addressed. And I think the humanitarian situation in Gaza has to be addressed." And you know how well Netanyahu's going to hear all this. He's thinking, yeah, yeah, right. Like, we're going to do a damn thing you want us to do, bub. That's just how it goes. It is how it goes. And they want him to jumpstart the peace talks again. And he met with him, 2 hours? And Netanyahu said he agreed to renew discussions as soon as possible with the Palestinians, but said nothing would happen until they accepted Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state. Well, I don't suppose that's going to happen anytime soon, and I don't suppose that Israel is going to recognize any of the Palestinians' rights in the area, because they never have and they never will. Isn't it something that a country maybe the size of the county next door to me here in Florida is able to lead our government leaders around by the nose? Our entire policy in the Middle East is dictated by Israel. You know, we got them threatening to bomb Iran. Their treatment of the people of Gaza is a travesty. And really all of their neighbors. It's a ticking time bomb. And they have no intention of keeping their word about stopping the settlements. I think we ought to know that by now. I think they'll do whatever they want to do. And our government will continue to kowtow to them and fund them. It's incredible. It's positively incredible to me. Like I said, a country the size of the county next door here. It's a bigger county than one I live in. It's amazing the influence they have on the government of the United States. I just don't get it. I never will. I've heard all the arguments. And usually in any argument, you can put yourself on the other side of the fence and maybe get some understanding of what they're doing. But I don't get it. I really don't. And yet, you know, here you go again. When you discuss this, you're an anti-Semite, right? I don't know what it is. I've got Jewish friends, many. And they're not practicing Jews. Not a single one of them that I... Yeah, one. Okay, one that I know is a practicing Jew. But, man, don't you say anything about Israel and the settlements and the West Bank and in Gaza and all that. Don't you dare. I don't know. Nothing going to be settled there anytime soon, and I don't see any real indication that the Obama administration is going to step in there and try and put the hammer down on Israel and make them do anything. Cut them off. Threaten to cut them off if they don't do what we ask and try and get some peace in that area. They're not going to do it. And I see things aren't going all that great in Afghanistan either. We've got Mullen now saying it's going to take a couple of years till we see a turnaround in Afghanistan. I'm talking about the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mullen. I mean, another thing that I have a bone to pick with Obama. We can't be happy in agreement with everything that our new president says, and I'm certainly not in agreement with what he's done in Afghanistan, deploying 21,000 more Americans there. Taliban's been getting stronger and stronger. Violence is going up. I just think you read history. You know what the old saying about if you don't know your history, if you don't read your history, you're doomed to repeat it. If you don't understand it, we're going to repeat it. I'll predict right here and now that there's no way United States military will come out of Afghanistan with anything resembling a victory. And you need to read your history books. I'm sure you all have. You remember how the Russians left there with the tail between their legs, and others have as well, other invaders. It's not going to happen. I expect the rest of my life the drug lords will help control that country. There'll be plenty of opium growing, plenty of poppies. And it's not going to change. And they'll laugh as they see the Americans leaving with their tail between their legs, just like the Russians did. And the longer we're there, the angrier they get, because lots of civilians have been killed now, and that's added fuel to the fire. And as Obama said all along, and many others, Pakistan is where it's at. Now we've got up to about 1.5 million people have been displaced in Pakistan in the Swat Valley. 1.5 million. And so now we have to have some sort of an operation in that, it's in the northwestern region, to get aid to these people. The militants are saying they're going to fight to the death. And that's an offensive that could last a long time in Pakistan, or as our president says, and he's correct, Pakistan. And so now the United Nations is saying it's going to have to launch an emergency appeal for hundreds of millions of dollars to help feed these people who fled the fighting in Swat. It's only about, 50, 60 miles from the capital, Islamabad? But here we are again. It's a major humanitarian challenge for the government and all the aid agencies. And we're in a world recession right now. And you got 20%, up to 20%, they say, of SWAT's displaced residents are in refugee camps, while most of them are living with their families in rented accommodations or someplace else. And it's hard to understand what's really going on there, because there's really very few news agencies in the area. And I was reading this morning that once again the Iraqis have stuck their fingers in our eyes and made it more difficult to get U.S. troops out of Iraq. They announced yesterday that the National parliamentary elections, which were scheduled for late December, now they're going to push them back to January 30th at the earliest. And they have to elect 275 members to their parliament, and then they got to get a new prime minister and a new cabinet. And that's where it really gets sticky for the United States. Because if there's no clear mandate for any particular party, it could mean complicated and really long, drawn-out negotiations that would delay forming a new president. I'll bet you a dollar to a donut that is exactly what ends up happening. And you know the ramifications of that. That's going to put the kibosh on the White House planning to pull most of the American combat forces out of the country by the end of August 2010. And I know President Obama agrees with his commanders that conditions on the ground should dictate how quickly the U.S. can leave Iraq, but if the elections cause a delay, that's going to disrupt the conditions. It's going to lead to more violence. And you wait and see, Obama's going to have to consider holding troops in Iraq longer than he originally promised. And that's going to be a problem. That's going to be a problem with a lot of people on the left. It's going to be a problem with me. I'll tell you what, I wouldn't want to be President Obama right now. I'm an insomniac. Natural born one, I think. And I have enough trouble sleeping. I don't know how he does it at all. I really do not. 866-546-5254 if you'd like to join us here on the program. 866-546-5254. I think we'll get the Media Matters Minute in here.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Ben Fischel. Our top item today, in discussing Speaker Nancy Pelosi and what she may or may not have known of the Bush administration's use of torture, many conservative media figures instead attacked Pelosi's appearance. That's right, rather than address the serious issues at hand, they instead obsessed over the speaker's looks.
So there is a conflict here. And I think if Speaker Pelosi were still capable of human facial expression, we'd see she'd be embarrassed, because right now she is in a very Nixon-like position.
What am I going to do, put Nancy Pelosi as a catcher? She'll get hurt. She's got all that plastic surgery. That would be terrible for her.
And how fun it is to watch that hag out there twisting in the wind.
She was shaking. She was a little, well, that could be Botox withdrawal. I don't want to be too hard on the shaking.
It's hard to imagine the right-wing noise machine talking this way about a male politician. For these stories and more, visit MediaMatters.org.
Yes, from our friends over at Media Matters. Yes, indeed, Rush, you don't want to talk about shaking now, do you, Rush? Yes, the de facto leader of the Republican Party doesn't want to talk too much about shaking, I'm sure. If anybody knows about shaking, withdrawal, and addiction and all that sort of thing, it's old Rushy Boy, the leader of the Republican Party. Now, a lot of people think that Steele is the leader of the Republican Party because he's ahead of the RNC. How long do you? I should take bets. How long do you think it's going to be before they kick him out or force him to jump? What do you think? I'm saying Steele won't last two more months as chairman of the RNC. Anybody want to take that bet? I think that they will force him out the door. I don't know who they'd put in his place, but first of all, let's be clear here. Let's be very, very clear here. Let's be perfectly honest about the situation with Michael Steele. The primary reason they haven't been happy with him, and were not many from the day one, is because he's black. Let's just get that out of the way right off the bat. He's a Republican, he's black, therefore he is not popular in the Republican Party. Never really has been, never will be. It was a miracle that they put him up as the, you know, their little deal of wanting to use him as a token didn't work out so well. Didn't work out so well at all. And probably the second thing that's going to cause him to be pushed out of his job is his big mouth. He certainly has opened his mouth and stuck his foot in several times. And a lot of them didn't like the fact that he said he wasn't necessarily going to be forced to call the Democrats. What was it they were going to call us? The Democratic Socialist Party? A Democratic Socialist Party. Hey, boys, call us anything you want. Call us every single derogatory name you can think of, because it's a free country and you can say anything you want to. But you better remember this. The real name of the Democratic Party is the party that's responsible for almost every single advancement this nation has ever made. Call us the party that's made this country prosperous and free. And call us the party that's done more for the working men and this women than your party has ever even thought about doing. Call us the party of that. Democratic Socialist Party, like, I give a damn what they want to call us. I sit here today as a liberal, not a progressive. I sit here as a liberal today. I am a liberal Democrat, and you've heard me say it 1,000 times. I will not be cowed into calling myself something, a different name, because the Republicans have made it so. I will not do that. And the idea that they're going to try and demonize the Democratic Party once again by calling us the Democrat Socialist Party, they can kiss my, you know what. It's absolutely laughable when you look over the years of what the Republican Party has achieved in this country and what the Democrats have achieved in this country when they've been in office. I mean, women wouldn't be voting, for God's sake. That took place when the Democrats were in charge. Mail delivery. Democrats were in charge for that. Mail. Child labor laws. I'm trying to think, the first child labor law was back along, I don't know, 1915, 1916, somewhere along there, and then our Supreme Court in all its wisdom declared the law unconstitutional a couple of years later. And then Democrats revised the law and got it going again, I don't know, 1940, 41, somewhere in there. Democrats were in charge all the time when that was happening. The TVA. Hell, all of Appalachia wouldn't have electricity if it wasn't for the Democrats. The REA, rural electrification. There's just so many things when you know, Medicare, Medicaid, educational advances in this country. Unemployment insurance was established by Democrats. Think of our schools. They got the hot lunch programs and the free textbooks for kids. How many superhighways would there be? Federal aid in building of roads and highways. Civil rights for all of our citizens. Hundreds of things that made the way of life better for all of Americans. It took place under Democratic administrations, a Democratic Congress. And what are the Republicans got to brag about? Tell me. Somebody tell me what they've got to brag about. Oh, we're conservative. Oh, I don't care what you call yourself. Tell me what you've done for America. Well, lower taxes. Again, tell me what you've done for America. Nothing. So when I first heard that they wanted to call us the Democratic Socialist Party, I had to laugh. I did. And I thought, okay, if they do that, and if they go through with it, and Michael Steele says he's not going to do it, but that they can't force him to do it, and that's what they want to do, maybe that's how they'll get him out. They'll make that a rule, and they all got to say that. I don't care. I do not care what they call us. You can, as the old, you can call me Ray, you can call me whatever. They've established, in essence, a huge gated community in this country. Filled with millionaires. They're above and beyond and better than the rest of us. That's who they've helped. That's what they've done. The Democratic Socialist Party.
Through you could we know God, and if we dared to question, He wouldn't spare the rod. For you we worked the soil. For you we dug the moors. For you we shed our blood and fought so many pointless wars. Now you try to tell us there's nothing we can do. You say the world around us belongs fairly to the few. But about 6 billion people no doubt will agree this world is our home, not your property. It's the commons,
far right of birth. And you who wouldn't close the land all around the earth, our future is your downfall when you cut this ball of shame. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. With our sweat we built the railroads, built cities on these shores, but because you own the money, you say that it's all yours. We laid the phone lines and the pipelines, and then right before our eyes, you say these things are taxes paid for, and now we'll privatize. Privatize the hospitals, privatize the schools, privatize the prisons for all those who break your rules. And preparing for the day when all the wells run dry, you say you own the very rain that falls down from the sky. But it's the commons are right of birth. And you who'd own the water all around the earth, our future is your downfall when you cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public goods for your private gain. You claim to own the harvest with your Terminator seed. You claim to own the genomes of every animal that breeds. You claim to own our culture and the music that we play. And with each song that we download to your coffers we must pay. You'd even own my name, and you'd say it's for the best. You'll let us on your radio, and our songs can pass your test. You own country, you own western, you say you've given us a choice. You may own the airwaves, but you'll never own my voice. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who'd own the music all around the earth, our future is your downfall when you cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who would own everything all around the earth, our future is your downfall when they cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain.
Yeah, the Traveling Wilburys. I've been on a kick with them lately. It's all right. You know it is going to be all right. It is. I don't know when. I don't know exactly when, but it's going to be all right. I think we're in the clutches of a nasty economic time. You all know that. People losing their homes, losing their jobs, and still at record rates. I don't know how it is where you live, but you couldn't get a job around here to save your ass. Thousands and thousands of homes. I believe 29,000 in backlog here, foreclosures every single day. Every single day. A couple of pages of foreclosures in the newspaper here. Big newspaper pages. Every day. And they even brought in extra judges trying to wade through them, and they can't, I suppose they're catching up. But it's, the newspaper described hunger. Hunger in Lee County, Florida, a once prosperous community. All the relief agencies, all the church agencies, the Harry Chapin Food Bank, who does wonderful, oh my God, wonderful work in this area, are just tapped out. There is so much hunger. Children and families going hungry. This isn't a third world country I'm talking about. This is Lee County, Florida, and it's happening more and more across this country. I don't know whether we're going to have to set up soup lines again or what, but there's lots of shelters and places offering mass feedings for people. But our local newspaper here last week took 3 or 4 days and had the lead story every day on hunger. Hunger. Children going to school, the only meal they get is at school. Children taking doggy bags home from school so that they can share. People going to the food pantry and there's nothing to get. I thought, and I had on the rose-colored glasses just like a lot of people, I thought never, never, never in my lifetime would I ever see that. Never. And it has happened because a certain class of people, a certain segment of people in this country have sucked the life financial blood out of most of many Americans. And we're going to discuss that tomorrow. We're going to discuss exactly how the fat cats have sucked the money out of the economy and put it in their pockets. And we're going to tell you just exactly how they've done it. And we'll give you some examples of the greed. The greed, the unadulterated greed. And I probably don't have to tell you that. You've seen it on the news. You've seen it on the TV shows. You've read accounts of it. But a certain class of people in this country have stuffed their pockets full of money. There are many Bernie Madoffs in this country, maybe not quite to that degree, but there are many Bernie Madoffs who have stuffed their pockets full of money so they don't need another dollar ever in the rest of their lives, and they've taken it from many of the rest of us. They've robbed people of the equity that they've had in their homes. They've taken the equity of the entire country and put it in their pockets. And that's what we're going to talk about tomorrow on the program, so be ready for that. And also, I want to tell you something. We're going to have a surprise guest on tomorrow. I'm going to tell you what the surprise is right now. We're going to have Bob Barr on the program tomorrow. You heard me right. Bob Barr is going to be on the program tomorrow, and he's going to be talking about this automobile mess. What are we going to do if General Motors and Chrysler and shouldn't you be able to take your car to any old mechanic and get it taken care of rather than having to take it to a Chrysler dealer or a General Motors dealer? And Bob Barr has been doing a lot of things since he's been out of office, and this is one of them. So we're going to have Bob Barr on the program. I never thought I'd ever say that. Uh-uh. But we're going to have Bob Barr on the program tomorrow. So, interesting. So, hey, thanks for joining us. I do want you to please remember this is a listener-supported program. Help this show. Help the horn. I'm serious about that. And we could certainly use your help right now, and I think you know that, and I know how it is. Anyway, you are listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. And don't forget, you've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. See you tomorrow, gang.